This is KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. This week, we remember the late Scotty Moore, who played guitar with Elvis Presley during the historic early days of rock and roll. He died last month at the age of 84. But first, we discuss Paul McCartney and the Beatles with biographer Philip Norman. A novelist and music historian, Philip Norman is the author of Shout, The Beatles in Their Generation, published 35 years ago. Shout was the first serious biography of the Beatles. Since then, Philip Norman has written about the Rolling Stones, Elton John, and Buddy Holly. A few years ago, he wrote a biography of John Lennon, and now Philip Norman has published Paul McCartney, The Life. Philip Norman, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much.
Visual artists often make several works with the same image from different perspectives or with a different light, and here you are telling the story of the birth of the Beatles for the third time.
That's right, like Monet and his water lilies.
What compelled you to revisit this subject?
Well, I had accepted, like a lot of people, that the view of Paul McCartney as being someone with enormous gifts, who therefore, I mean, the gift of huge talent, obviously, of wonderful good looks and of huge charm, as someone who was complacent and self-satisfied and didn't really make much of an effort. But I just thought I ought to try to look behind that. And indeed, there is a very different Paul McCartney, one which the world really sort of little suspects, who is actually very much more complex than he seems, and in his own way, as insecure as John Lennon used to be. John was insecure because of family reasons. Paul had a very happy family life, despite having lost his mother when he was 14 years old. But very, very insecure about his own talent. The evidence of that is that he's still out there performing many, many nights of the year, wanting to prove himself all over again on a stage with Beatles material, very largely, even though he's now getting into his 70s.
Do you think Paul McCartney's desire to have the writing credits reversed on several of the songs that Paul thought he was the primary contributor to, having the credit reversed from Lennon and McCartney to McCartney-Lennon, do you think that's a manifestation of his insecurity?
Well, I think it gives comfort to us all, really, that someone so successful, so famous, who's received such honors, such adulation, can still sort of have a niggling worry about the order of his name in the songwriting credits, although he has rather stopped that now. But it's really more that his desire to keep on proving himself, to keep on writing, keep on recording, keep on performing, which is extraordinary because you just would think there was nowhere else to go after achievements like his.
The story of the Beatles takes up about 50% of your Paul McCartney biography. Were you at all tempted to start your story in 1970 and not tell the story of the Beatles again?
No, I wasn't. It had to be the life. But at the same time, I realized that the Beatles story now is such a sort of part of partly modern history, partly mythology, that I could not just plod through the whole story all over again. I had to keep McCartney center stage and have the story going on around him, really. And I knew that when I mentioned Abbey Road Studios in London, people knew what that was, or if I mentioned the Cavern in Liverpool where the young Beatles, you know, sort of cut their teeth as performers. I knew that people would know that, so I didn't simply start from the very beginning with the story. I assumed knowledge, which of course is there.
Well, the Beatles have been so important to me, and I'm guessing to you. But I always find it difficult to explain the effect of the Beatles, and it goes beyond the music, although the music is at the heart of the story. You know, why are they so great? And they say are and not were.
They combined two extraordinary talents, and yet they were four people, and each of those four members was important. And it's the template of the pop band that is still being played out to this day, each of whose members has a different sort of appeal to different people. So John was the intelligent, rather unpredictable one. Paul was the very sweet, tuneful, cute one. George was the rather mysterious, quiet one. And Ringo was what someone once described to me as the adorable runt of the litter. I mean, that formula is still the template for a pop band to this day.
The Beatles also had such a far-reaching effect on our society.
Of course, the world was so very different at the beginning of the 60s as well, and much, much less cynical. And, you know, all of the sort of modern phenomena of culture, celebrity culture that are so familiar barely existed then. I mean, there were just a few mega celebrities in the world, mostly from the world of movies, not from pop music. Pop music had a sort of, you know, pretty bad image, and these were pop stars like none before. They were very, very charming, very clever, very quick-witted, but at the same time, not at all threatening. Now, this was, of course, ironic because, you know, their past, as I'm sure you know, had been extremely sleazy, and they had, you know, they had been through some very, very sleazy environments, and you know, their history was not very creditable in some ways. Whereas the Rolling Stones, who became the symbol of sort of total wickedness for a pop band in the 60s, really were quite blameless. They were just young blokes from the Kentish suburbs and London suburbs who wanted to play the blues. They got stuck with this sort of image of sort of really the Antichrist, and the Beatles were the adorable mop top.
So the Beatles were the true sinners more than the Rolling Stones?
They had. I mean, you know, Liverpudlians are very... They grew up very quickly in Liverpool. It's a very hard city, and they'd been to Hamburg as very young boys, a sexual awakening, which of course for them had come before that. So when this enormous, unprecedented fame fell onto them, they could deal with it. You know, it would have killed a lot of other people. Really, I mean, the pace that they lived at for 5 or 6 years was murderous. They could survive it.
When we first spoke, Philip Norman, after you had written your book about John Lennon, we spoke about your book, Shout, The Beatles and Their Generation, and how that book was maybe a little unfair to Paul McCartney. Well, do you think now that you've written a book about Paul McCartney that has his tacit approval, or were you afraid of being too nice to Paul?
I thought I must be careful, yes. I just mustn't sort of seem to be sort of just trying to sort of, you know, to make the case too hard that... you know, there really is a lot to this man that I didn't realize before. I was unfair to him. There's absolutely no doubt about it, and I admit it. There had been, when I wrote the John Lennon book, he had been in touch with me. He'd phoned me, and I really only wanted to speak to him to assure him that this was not going to be an anti-McCartney book. But in the end, he did help me a lot with the book, but by email. So when the idea came into my head for doing this book, I got a very, very quick response from him, and it was just saying, go ahead, I will give you my tacit approval. I didn't think he would sit down at his time of life and, again, sort of go through the whole story of the Beatles step by step, which I wasn't going to do anyway in the book. What was really more valuable was that I had access to family members and to very, very close friends and associates of his, who normally just would not speak to a writer.
Having received Paul McCartney's approval for your book, Philip Norman, where did you go and who did you talk to that you hadn't talked to before?
Well, there were a lot of people, and of course, you know, there were many, many years after the official breakup of the Beatles, who were part of his life and part of his career, a very unstable and changing lineup for the band Wings, of course, through the 70s. But there were people like John Eastman, who became Paul's brother-in-law, his wife Linda's brother, who had been very much involved with the last days of the Beatles and the breakup and the litigation that Paul brought against John, George and Ringo, had since 1968 never spoken to a single journalist or writer of any kind, who was tremendously helpful to me, who not only talked to me a lot, but then checked the manuscript as well, and of course had an amazing story to tell, which was again totally counter to the received history, which suggested that Paul was just glided from the Beatles into a solo career, confident in his own abilities, and just started Wings, and that was all fine, and he just, you know, never looked back. Wasn't a bit like that at all. He was traumatized by the last days of the Beatles, particularly when the other three sidelined him, because it was arranged that John Eastman and John's father, Lee Eastman, Linda's father, who was a very successful entertainment lawyer in New York. He was set to be the Beatles' manager. Then John found Alan Klein, and it all went into reverse. And of course, Paul could not bear Alan Klein, so the other three simply just sidelined him, and he had a really terrible effect on him. He had virtually a breakdown on his remote Scottish farm, and really hit the bottle as well, the whiskey, drinking whiskey in the mornings. But he got through it. And, you know, it's his amazing constitution, but also his extraordinary ability to see the positive side of life, which, of course, has been in his music right from the beginning. Even when he was in jail in Japan, he made the most of the experience. When he was on the Beatles' first terrible tour of Scotland, backing a singer called Johnny Gentle, Paul got absolutely everything positive there was out of it.
We're speaking with Philip Norman. His latest book is Paul McCartney, The Life. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. You paint a vivid picture of the depressed Paul McCartney holed up in his home in Scotland, and that also corresponded with conspiracy theorists coming up with the idea that Paul McCartney was actually dead and that the clues were all contained in Beatles albums.
That was extraordinary. That was something that, you know, went viral before there was anything like the internet or Twitter. That went round the world, instantaneously, quite extraordinary, in advance of the technology that could have supported it.
Well, some of the clues that the conspiracy theorists found in the Beatles albums and album covers are undoubtedly there, and there was a theory that maybe the Beatles had planted them to increase record sales.
Yes. In fact, I was around. I was covering for an American magazine the story of the end of the Apple organization, and I was around the Apple house in Savile Row when Paul was not there, and it was very strange because he'd been there so much. He was so much involved in starting the business and in running the record label, Apple Records, which, contrary to, you know, the sort of history of waste and disaster around the Apple organization, the record company run by Paul, was very, very successful. But then suddenly he simply disappeared, and John and Yoko moved in, and Ringo and George were around, but Paul had simply left, had just vanished. And in those days, there were, you know, communications. There were only telephones and telegrams, so you could become incommunicado in the British Isles for weeks on end.
So you don't think the Beatles had anything to do with planting any of the clues?
No. I think it was a sort of manifestation of the tremendous, you know, the hippie culture and finding, you know, mysticism in everything and signs and, you know, portents and all of that. And it was picked up. Of course, it was encouraged by newspapers as well. And it really was sort of more an American phenomenon than a UK one. And in fact, it was an American magazine. It was Life magazine that finally revealed that he was still alive.
Paul is still with us.
Right.
That was a beautiful picture of Paul and Linda on the cover of that Life magazine. I had it up on my wall. Paul was amazingly photogenic.
Yes. They were all terribly photogenic, but, I don't think in all these years he's ever really taken a bad photograph. I mean, even in moments of after the murder of John, I think then, you know, he looked terribly haggard, and people thought he didn't care because he made some flip sort of remark, but in fact, obvious, it hit him terribly hard.
Well, Paul McCartney has often been criticized for a lack of emotion, but you point out in your book that that's pretty common for a Liverpudlian.
Well, that was true of particularly young men and particularly young British men in those years. I mean, you know, if you remember the film Nowhere Boy, supposedly about the young teenage John Lennon, they're all sort of hugging each other and crying and everything. No young man did that in the 1960s. And Paul particularly had a way of, as he said after the death of his mother when he was only 14, he put a shell around himself. He did not show emotion. But then later on, of course, times had changed very much by the time of his wife Linda's death, and he had children as well, you know, who needed to sort of support each other and show emotion, and they did.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're talking with Philip Norman, whose new book is a biography of Paul McCartney.
A criticism that's always leveled at Paul McCartney is that his post-Beatles songwriting is not as good as his Beatles songs.
Well, he didn't stop being a great songwriter just because he left the Beatles and because he was playing in a band, you know, that were part of the sort of glam rock era, you know, with his wife Linda on keyboards. But they were very much about putting out commercial albums, and there was not the consistent sort of wonderful idiomatic lyrics that he'd been writing with the Beatles, with, you know, and sparking creativity off of John Lennon. But there are, you know, there are songs among that mass of Wings material that are really wonderful. There's a song called Dear Friend, which is a tribute to John, which was on probably one of the most criticized of all the Wings albums, called Wild Life. It's a beautiful song. It sums up so much in so few words. John never realized it existed. If he had realized, he would not have written the horrible How Do You Sleep, in a sort of retaliation against Paul. There's one later on called Waterfalls, where Paul's voice is very different from how it usually is. And no, it doesn't have that buoyancy, that optimism. It's years before Linda became ill, and yet there's a sort of premonition that he'll lose her in that song. So they're there, just as in John Lennon's solo output. Even some of John's tracks with Yoko are really good. But the world did not want to acknowledge this at the time. The world wanted the Beatles back and didn't want to acknowledge their solo careers at all, or hardly.
Well, within the Beatles, when you're working with four other people, including George Martin, there was a lot of competition to get your best work on the record. Whereas when you're a solo artist, you can put all your songs on the record, or a three-record set, like George Harrison did.
That's true. Well, of course, George, in the end, he was around, you know, two brilliant songwriters. And it really rubbed off, and, you know, that hugely successful triple album, All Things Must Pass, was kind of the backlog. You know, All Things Must Pass, in a sort of digestive sense, in a way, and it was like unblocking a sort of bad case of constipation. But as time went on, you know, he did not keep up that level because he wasn't around the other two.
The Beatles' solo careers began with lots of songs that had been rejected from the Beatles, and that was true with Paul. He had Teddy Boy and Junk.
Yes, he had. I mean, again, you don't think of those reversals. You don't think of his having been rejected. You think he was the sort of, you know, the scheming brain behind the Beatles and getting all his stuff on the albums. And, you know, he suffered reverses and humiliations and, you know, all the time, really. And again, it's not part of the Paul McCartney legend. It seems like he just breezed through everything, and he didn't.
Don't go jumping waterfalls. Please keep to the lake. People who jump waterfalls sometimes can make mistakes.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're talking with Philip Norman, whose new book is a biography of Paul McCartney called Paul McCartney, The Life. Well, he did seem to be breezing along, but then Heather Mills came into his life, and you spend quite a bit of time in your book talking about that unhappy period.
Yes. He'd had an amazingly successful marriage, marriage that was so disapproved of when he married Linda in 1969. You know, she was getting just as much horrible treatment from the press and from Beatles fans as Yoko was getting because of having taken away John. It turned into a wonderfully happy, successful, fulfilling marriage. And he was in a vulnerable state afterwards. And this very powerful, charismatic, attractive woman who had overcome a really awful, you know, awful accident which left her with a disability. He was very susceptible to that because also he had this kind of caring gene. His mother had been a nurse. His mother had been a wonderfully kind woman, looked after her patients as a midwife very, very well. Paul had inherited that and also had been Linda's, to some extent, Linda's carer during Linda's illness. So, he, as he said to someone in Liverpool his friend said, "Why did you fall for Heather in that way? You're so usually so astute and so cautious." And he said, "Well, I just looked at her leg and went, ah." And that really explains it.
Do you think Heather Mills was a scheming, lying gold digger?
No, I don't think that was what she was about. What I do think is that she didn't really appreciate the magnitude of Paul's fame and considered herself an equal celebrity. And still does, in fact.
Have you ever had the opportunity to talk to Heather Mills?
I have actually talked to her, and yes, I have, and it's not something that I can really sort of put into the book, unfortunately.
Oh, you can tell us.
No, I can't.
Well, now Paul McCartney has a new wife. What do you know about her?
Somebody said, people didn't realize that, of course, Linda came from New York and was from a family that was originally Jewish. Although they were not sort of observant. And her name had originally been Epstein, the same as name as the Beatles' first manager, strangely enough. And Nancy also is from a Jewish background, and she's very wealthy in her own right. She's thoroughly chic and, wonderful. Does not try to intrude on his spotlight at all. He's told someone else that in his later years, all he really wanted was someone to be there when he came off stage in the evening and say, "You were wonderful, darling." And one gets the feeling Nancy would be that person.
Nancy is still younger than Paul, but maybe more age-appropriate.
Possibly so, yes. There was a large age difference between himself and Heather. And Nancy is obviously a very sophisticated woman, a very understanding woman, and she gets on very, very well with his children, particularly his son James. And there was a big problem with James and Heather.
What did Nancy do before she met Paul?
Well, she was her father was a very successful owner of a trucking business, and she served on various municipal transport authorities in New York. She's a woman of great, resource and character and energy, but also highly cultured, all the things that he would like.
We were talking a bit ago about how photogenic the Beatles were, and your book, Paul McCartney, The Life, has two beautiful photo sections. Why did you feel the need to include photos, and how did you choose which photos you would use?
Well, people would have been very critical if there hadn't been images of Paul. Some of the pictures are quite sort of revealing. For instance, there's a really sad one of Paul and Linda at one of Stella McCartney's fashion shows when Linda is very ill, and you can see a lot of pain and endurance in both Linda's and Paul's faces while they're watching Stella's fashion shows. There's a very revealing picture from the early days of the Beatles, sort of Beatlemania days, when John is sitting on the edge of a stage and Paul is whispering in his ear, and John is sort of, his expression is, "Okay, I'll go along with that." Of course, John went along with so much for so long.
You mentioned in the book about how John Lennon was just as enthusiastic as Paul in adopting the Beatles' famous uniforms on stage and giving up their leather.
Oh, yes. They were, being given very nice suits, as they were by Brian Epstein. John didn't object to that. He did later think they'd had to sell out. But it took quite a long time for John to sort of become that way. For, the sheer excitement and euphoria and the feeling their music was so much, embraced by so many people. They were writing for a long time sort of pop songs they thought the public wanted, and they didn't really know what the public wanted, so they thought every song title had to have the word you or me in it for a long time, and so many of their early songs did.
Well, that's one of the most amazing things about the Beatles. They learned early on what a hit formula would be, but then they abandoned it.
Exactly, and the strides that their talent took were extraordinary. I mean, just two or three years, you know, they went from, you know, Please Please Me to Revolver, you know, and Tomorrow Never Knows, and all that, you know, and so many influences went into their music, of course, but so much totally original material came out of them.
You think there's new Paul McCartney music to come?
Well, his albums, you know, still do well and sometimes do very, very well. And I think you just cannot stop the music and all this desire to prove himself still to this day in his, you know, getting on for his mid-70s.
When Paul McCartney performs today, there's lots of Wings and Beatles songs in the set, and yet somehow it never feels like an oldies show.
It doesn't, of course, because the Beatles songs just don't, you know, they don't ever seem to get old. They sound absolutely fresh, and he does many, many Beatles songs in his stage performance, which is, you know, 2 to 3 hours without an intermission, without even a sip of water very often. But then he does quite a few of his experimental tracks, you know, the Wings stuff and the post-Wings stuff as well. But many, many Beatles numbers, a lot of them more associated with John than with Paul, actually.
He's digging deep into his catalogue these days.
Absolutely, and even something, you know, quite sort of experimental solo McCartney tracks like Temporary Secretary, that gets done nowadays.
Well, this book by Philip Norman, Paul McCartney, The Life, it weighs about 65 pounds.
Well, listen, you go into a bookstore these days and you'll find, you know, 1,000 pages on Henry Kissinger, and that's only up to World War II. You know, this is The Life of McCartney up to the age of 73 in a book that still won't rupture you, I hope.
It's a phenomenal book.
Thank you.
The author is my guest, Philip Norman. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
My pleasure. Nice to talk to you. Bye-bye.
In 1954, Elvis Presley made his historic first recordings at Sam Phillips's Sun Records in Memphis. At Elvis's side was guitarist Scotty Moore, who helped develop the sound that would become known as rock and roll. Scotty Moore died in June at the age of 84. From the Bookshelf remembers him this week with this interview from 2013 upon the publication of Scotty Moore's autobiography. So can you take us back to that day in July 1954? What happened when you guys came up with that record, That's All Right?
Oh, hell broke loose.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right with you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama. Any way you do. And Mama, she done told me. Papa done told me too. Son, that guy you fooling with, she ain't no good for you. But that's all right. That's all right. It's all right now, Mama, any way you do.
Starlight Wranglers that had been working with when I got out of the service, and just became good friends with Sam, and he had just asked me if we me and Bill would come in, had this new boy that he wanted to hear, so it was just an audition actually for him too.
Had you ever recorded at Sun before?
Yes, we had one record out on the group we've been playing with,
mm-hmm.
But it was a country western group. Well, like I said, Sam asked asked me and Bill come in. We had this new boy. He wanted to hear. And it was just an audition for Elvis. And we went in there and it was just whatever the songs he knew, we try to play a little bit of them, and Sam was fiddling with the Mac, you know, the equipment and listening to different things. One song, we just started doing kind of a rhythm thing, and it all fell together. There was no you do this, you do that, or thing. It just kind of happened, you know.
You didn't work out any parts in advance. It just
no, not really. None of us read music anyway.
And how long had you been playing? You'd already been a player for quite a while.
Well, no. I'd just gotten out of the Navy about a year before, and had played quite a bit in the Navy, but still not a group or anything like that. Just more, you know, two, three guys get together and might play a little bit or something. And but no training really of any sort. Everything was just off the cuff, you know.
What kind of a guy was Bill Black, your bass player?
Very jovial, good bass player, and he was always he acted the clown on stage a lot too, and did that. He had been the clown part with when I had the country group before we started with Elvis. And he'd actually put on old clothes and do a clown routine, you know, be part of the show that way. And it was just another thing to work the crowd up, you know.
Well, you do make a point in your book, Scotty and Elvis Aboard the Mystery Train, that it really was a group that you were a part of, that it was Elvis Presley, Scotty, and Bill, not two guys backing up Elvis Presley.
Well, to begin with, it was, yes. three of us after we did the first record, which the first record was just an audition for Sam to hear him sing. It was just a friendship thing. There's no planning at all on the whole situation.
And so you had to record a B-side.
Sam had took the thing that we had recorded at night to Dewey Phillips, who was a local disc jockey, and he had played it that night and gotten so many requests and stuff that the next day Sam called us and told us that we're going to have to get a B-side for that real quick if we want to make a record out of it, because we had so many requests for that one side last night. And that's when we cut the Blue Moon of Kentucky, which each time was it wasn't just like walk in and do it and you're through. We spent I don't remember, probably 3 or 4 hours at least on either side, you know, till you found something that worked and what we were playing. And because none of us were school musicians by any sort.
Can you tell us about your first live performance with Elvis?
It was outside, and we were just like an extra attraction. And I don't remember how Sam got us on that thing to begin with.
And the audience reaction that I guess is so famous now from a couple of years later, was that evident in the first few performances you did?
Well, it was the best way to say that, the main identification of it was that we were doing something so much different than they were used to hearing or seeing. It was a real small group, number one. I guess one of the first things that we noticed, or mainly Bill would have noticed for it right off, and Elvis, that all the young girls were very enthralled about his movements on stage. He was very animated in playing, and he wasn't a dancer, but he danced.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Then, shortly thereafter, with Colonel Parker came in on the scene and was really courting Elvis and his family.
We went to the Grand Ole Opry. Sam took us up there, and I think the story is that he saw the crowd reaction.
But in your book, you mentioned that you got a sort of a sinking feeling when Colonel Parker came on the scene.
from past things I had heard, I didn't know him as a person or anything. Just made me a little skittish, maybe. We were doing pretty good doing the shows and things we were doing, and then we had... Bob Neal was kind of a manager, and then later on, Parker came in. He was about behind. It was behind the scenes. All I don't know any of the details, you know, that were going on there. I was busy trying to stay in tune.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're listening to my 2013 interview with the late Scotty Moore, who played guitar with Elvis Presley. It's remarkable in your book that you don't express any resentment towards Elvis, but I think everybody who reads the book will be pretty shocked to learn that while Elvis became a billionaire, you and Bill were, you know, basically still making the same amount of money that you were making when you recorded That's All Right, Mama.
Well, that was a lot of that is because of the Colonel, because his background had been working with a lot of the Grand Ole Opry groups. That they had a front man, and then the musicians are hired either by the job or on some small salary. And it just wasn't the times is usually just the front man or the main guy who's the one that made the most money, or the manager or somebody like that. The rest of the guys were just hired to play one at their instrument and be quiet.
Even though you were as much an architect of Elvis Presley's sound as Elvis was.
Well, in the very beginning, it had to be, because I was the only one playing anything other than rhythm, you know.
Yeah, yeah. In your book, you talked a little bit about rock and roll, and you said that you don't really consider the records that you made at Sun to be rock and roll records, although, and today they sound like country records, but country music didn't sound anything like that then.
Right. It was rock and roll hadn't been, the term hadn't been invented yet.
Ride 16 coaches long. Train a ride 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train got my baby and gone. Train coming round the bend. Train coming round the bend. Well, it took my baby, but it never will again. No, not again. Train coming down the line. Train coming down the line. Well, it's bringing my baby, 'cause she's my all mine. She's my all mine. Well, it took my baby, but it never will again.
You also went to Hollywood with Elvis, and you're in some of the movies.
In the very early days, we were, yes. We did, yeah, we always did most of the band parts, right.
It's Loving You, where there's a scene where Elvis is playing the guitar. It's a close-up on Elvis, but that's really you who's doing the playing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I had to put on his shirt, right. And then, yeah, there was a close-up shot, which is that Elvis was supposed to be playing the solo on the song, and it was actually me playing. That's the reason I had to do that.
Hmm.
So they had a lot of shots, finger work, I guess. I don't even, I have to go back and look at it, to tell you the truth.
Well, we're talking with Scotty Moore, and he's written his story in a marvelous book that you should all read. It's called Scotty and Elvis Aboard the Mystery Train. You know, in your book, I was just so interested to hear that you'd not only recorded with Elvis, but you've also recorded with Paul McCartney, and you've recorded with Keith Richards. So you've worked with the greats, all the greats, and the milestones in rock and roll. Can you compare working with those guys?
Well, they were, my memory of all the guys were, they were all good to work with, and it was head sessions, it wasn't written. Just they picked their own songs, and we just went in and whatever you felt like playing, you did. That was about it.
I imagine that both Paul McCartney and Keith Richards feel they owe you a lot.
Well, they're free to send money anytime.
Mm-hmm. A conversation with the late, great Scotty Moore, who played guitar with Elvis Presley, closing out this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and hear us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. I also want to thank Philip Norman for being on the show. Check out his new book, A Biography of Paul McCartney. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next week.